sequentially from where I've been speaking in First Canto, Chapter 17, Text 25. The title of the chapter is Punishment and Reward of Kali, and the scene is Maharaj Parikshit has left the palace of Hastinapur, having that in his kingdom some unbelievable atrocity is being performed, beating of a bull by a person dressed as a king, obviously not a king, unqualified person, but imitating or posing himself as a king. So immediately gets his whole army to go to where that place is, and upon arriving at the place, he confronts the scene, and there's the scene. There's the man with a personality of Kali, with a club in his hand, smashing the legs of the bull. And he has a trial right on the spot. My dear Mr. Bull, can you identify who is doing this to you? What's the cause of your suffering? It's obvious there's a man with the stick that he's beating. But the response that comes is, it's very difficult to say what's the cause of one's suffering. And there's lots of opinions about what's the cause of one's suffering. Some say it's the stars. Some say it's karma. Some say it's the inherent nature of matter. Some say this, some say that. Some say it's inexplicable. But you're a pure devotee. You're an elevated soul in touch with the personality of Godhead, and He knows. So since you're so intimately connected with Him, for sure you will know too. Can you say what's the cause of suffering? Our Acharyas explained that commonly, in a sequence, when the final thing is stated, it's the final thing that's the right answer. And in fact, nishchayaha is a word indicating that that's the answer. Nishchayaha means definitely concluded. So the definitely concluded part is, it's inexplicable. And confirmed by Bhishma Dev, who says, what's the plan of the Lord? Who can say? Even great rishis, this is his consoling of Maharaj Yudhisthira in the ninth chapter of this first canto. Don't try to understand the plan of the Lord, because it's inexplicable. And then, in the purport, Prabhupada proceeds to explain that which is inexplicable can be known if it's disclosed. If Krishna says, this is my purpose, then you know his purpose. Just like to understand in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, nobody knows me. In fact, any living being that's born, listen to this logic, any living being that comes into being cannot know its source or origin. Like, what existed before we existed? We can't know because it existed before we existed. So we can't know. Unless that which existed before we existed discloses our source and origin. Then we can know. So, higher truths are known by disclosure. Not by a descending process, not by an ascending process. And otherwise you can't know. You can bluff. You can say perhaps, maybe. You can even say definitely it was like this. But that's bluff. You don't know. Fact is, be honest, you don't know. Unless there's disclosure. So then Prabhupada, in the purport, discloses why this, not only Prabhupada, Acharyas disclose. There are two reasons why this whole scene is taking place. One of them is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur summarizes it this way, or paraphrases the Buddha saying, actually this whole situation is being arranged for me to be in this difficulty so that the glories of the personality of Godhead can be spoken. And I accept that what appears to be distress is simply an arrangement by the Supreme Lord, who I'm the servant of, to manifest the glories of the Supreme Lord, who I'm the servant of. And so, for that purpose, I accept. The bull wasn't whining and complaining, oh, my master, you let me down. Look at this. Three of my four legs are broken. So that the glories of the Lord can be manifest. And if one can be an instrument for that, let's just say parenthood, you know, being a mother. And so much trouble mothers go through for the sake of their children. But they're very happy because that's the happiness of motherhood, is taking care of their children. But you look at it objectively and you couldn't pay people to do what they're doing. What a job. And just continuing to do it with great affection. So it's that's the position of the devotee. That's indirectly what it's inexplicable. If there's a plan of the Lord, he wants his glories to be known to people who presently do not know them. Like when people have forgotten the purpose of life, the Supreme Lord descends to remind them of what is that purpose. He may descend through the medium of his devotees and the situations of the devotees' lives. And then the purpose of the Lord can be known, and through that the Lord can be known. And the other is that the glories of Maharaj Parikshit should be known. Or what is the standard of a really quality person, a real quality administrator, is that not only they know the difference between right and wrong, which the bull has said to Maharaj Parikshit, you know, but not only they know how to administer according to sometimes very complex situations. In this case, here's the bull, here's Mother Earth, both being harassed viciously by the personality of sin personified, the personality of Kali. Now how to address that? If it's your duty to do so. You know, most people on the sidelines, bystanders, spectators going, look at that! They should do something. What's wrong with them? And then when you're them, then what do you do? It's very, very challenging. So, to exhibit the glories of Maharaj Parikshit. And he's just about to exhibit his glories. After hearing from the bull speaking in that way, Maharaj Parikshit says, from the way that you've spoken, not just that, you know, you've said something interesting and philosophical, instead of just saying, he did it. Because it's obvious. He's got the stick in his hand. He's beating my legs. He did it. But behind that instrument, that individual is the instrument of my karma, is it simply then my karma? Some say it's my karma. This is happening because it's my karma. That has the instrument, but it's my own karma. And then what's behind karma, what's its material nature, is acting according to certain laws, so it's material nature. And then who's controlling the material nature? There are demigods that are controlling material nature, so it's the demigods. You just keep going and, going, and then it becomes the Supreme Lord. Whoops, now God is responsible for myself. And then our acharyas go through that in their commentary. Actually, he's doing nothing at all. And he's neutral towards everyone. He's not favorable towards some and unfavorable towards others. So the ones he's unfavorable to, he smacks. Take that. That's not our Lord. So it's difficult to discern. Especially, emphasize, especially when it comes to the devotees. Because people say, you know, they're a good person. Why did something something bad happen? Why this misfortune? They didn't do anything wrong. They were good. Such a good devotee. Look at what happened. Why did this happen? You know, the inference is either indirect or sometimes it's directly explicit, like, why did Krishna do this? So, Maharaj Parikshit is recognizing that the depth of understanding of the bull is indicating he's not just, you know, a learned personality in the disguise of a bull, he is Dharma himself. Demonstrating this principle, it's a nice principle. One who is the finder of fault of another incurs the same reaction of as that person who is making that fault. Whoa. So what do? When there's something that's obvious, cause and effect, that's the cause. And if I say, that's the cause, I'm held responsible if the cause is making something bad happen. Just by the understanding is, if you stop there, yes. So one should be able, one should be Krishna conscious to see behind that cause there's something else. Like, let's say, for example, if someone is behaving very badly, it probably, may very well or probably be that they're suffering. They're suffering a whole lot. They're in great distress and pain and suffering, and something has happened in their life that is bringing about that pain and suffering and thus this bad behavior. So there's a cause that's that this bad behavior is the effect of. So we can feel empathy for the wrongdoer because there's some wrong that has been done to them, and that, that their, mis- their wrongdoing is the effect of that prior cause, and so on. If you only see the immediate situation and don't see, let's say, the bigger picture, then you become implicated in the material energy. So how do you keep the big picture. Ultimately, it's like Krishna consciousness, or as the narration unfolds, it's hearing the glories of the Lord spoken out of, you know, Shunvatasvakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana. It's that message from chapter 2 of this first canto. By hearing one's spiritual punya is awakened by Shravana Kirtana, by hearing and chanting in the association of others, one's own spiritual merit increases. And as one's spiritual merit increases, then you have more strength to see Krishna in even difficult circumstances. So this is an application point. Listen carefully. People say, yeah, but it's really complex. Life is complex, and you know, it's very nice speaking these things in a classroom setting like this, but I go to the office, or I go to school, or I go into, you know, challenging situations, and all this stuff evaporates, and I'm just like, I'm down and dirty again, just struggling with the circumstance. Krishna disappears completely from the picture. And at the end of the day, when, you know, the 5 o'clock bell rings, I go, whoa, what happened? I just was in the boxing ring and got beat up. And that's called life. Maharaj, what do I do? Shrinvatamsakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana. So here's how, in the text itself, the drama is that three legs of the bull have been broken, and one leg is remaining, and even that one leg is not at full strength by any means. And the duty of Maharaj Parikshit is to administer to that condition in such a way full strength is restored to all four of the legs of the bull. So, same for us. You know, we're confronted with circumstances of life in this age of Kali that are very challenging. The pillars of even goodness, what to speak of God consciousness, are smashed. And we're supposed to go through that territory and be Krishna conscious, or to speak of good. That's challenging. So how do you do it? Listen carefully. Maharaj Parikshit is going to explain this. So he's appreciated, you are the personality of religion. Thus it is concluded that the Lord's energies are inconceivable. That is to say, the remote cause is Krishna, and everything is happening through his energies, and how his energies are moving and mixing, even his energies are inconceivable, what to speak of himself. But here we are, life, with inconceivable energies moving and mixing. No one can estimate them, his inconceivable energies, by mental speculation or word jugglery. Don't try to figure it out. And don't pretend that you know and just say a bunch of nice words and da-da-da-da-da-da, word jugglery. It looks, sounds good. The plan of the Lord is not discernible by that method, by disclosure. So then, disclosure says, then I need to fix my mind upon the personality of Godhead in devotion, and if he so desires, he can disclose. That's what I do in challenging situations. Like, at once. Here comes, you're going down the path of life, and here comes a challenge. What do I do with this challenge? Krishna! Krishna, you've you put me on this path and I trust you, and here's this challenge I don't understand how to deal with. Krishna! And then, Krishna, I don't hear you. Krishna, you're there, right? Maybe I should turn to those who are very dear to Krishna. Maybe they have the Krishna channel, you know, focused. And I can hear from them how to understand the situation, at least how to appropriately perform in the circumstance. Those that are dear to Krishna. He then says, Maharaj Parikshit speaks to the bull, in the age of satya, or truthfulness, your four legs were established by the four principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. That it appears that three of your legs are broken due to rampant irreligion in the form of pride, lust for women, and intoxication. Okay, so that's the diagnosis of the problem. Then, what's the cure? Text 25, this is the one that we're discussing. You are now standing on one leg only, which is your truthfulness, and you are somehow or other hobbling along, meaning even that truthfulness is weakened because you imagine a bull that's hobbling on one leg. That one leg is not functioning the way it normally would when there's four legs and it's moving nicely. Truthfulness, as we know it in the age of Kali, is weakened. It's not the truthfulness of Satya Yuga. The truthfulness of Satya Yuga can be restored. But it's not by word juggling or mental speculation or, you know, imagining it to be like that. There's standards, and the purport is disclosing very nicely those standards. But quarrel personified, Kali, flourishing by deceit, is also trying to destroy that leg. So that leg is also weakened. I'll summarize what Prabhupada is saying in the purport and we'll go into it. In summary, our message, the message from the Bhagavatam, is to become Krishna conscious. That's our target. That's like the point of the pin and the shaft of the pin, that which gives strength to that purpose is austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. So we, as devotees, need to frame our lives seeing to those four things, that they're an integral part of our life. The purpose of them is not just unto themselves. The purpose is so that we can go more deeply into fixing our consciousness always upon the personality of Godhead, Krishna. There's more to this discussion, but that's what this verse is presenting. So, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur describes specifically with reference to truthfulness. He explains that because of truth, when your quality is the quality of abiding by truth, never departing from truth, then you can, to some degree at least, you can fix your mind upon Krishna. Conversely, you can't fix your mind upon Krishna if that principle of truthfulness is depleted. or broken. And so one of the attacks of Kali is deceit. In the Sanskrit is anritena. Anritena is deceitfulness. When we, I conducted over the Christmas vacation a little seminar with the youth group in Chicago on self-honesty. One of the self-honesty questions was, why is it that we say things that we know that are not truthful? Why do we do that? And the example is, if somebody says, how many rounds have you chanted this morning so far? And I say, 5. Well, I know I've chanted 4. Just taking that as a simple little example they gave. Why do we do that? And why can't we just say the truth? I've chanted 4. And so many other little, you know, whatever we might call them, white lies or stretching the truth, or it goes on all the time. Why do we do that? And it's an influence of Kali. It's this position of pride. We want to appear like what we'd like to be rather than what we are. So we're projecting ourselves falsely. You know, nice packaging. It's like marketing. Put something in a nice package and inside is practically empty. One of Budrin Ryan's favorite stories, it's a long one. When he was real small, his mother wanted to do something nice for the kids, so she said, let's go to the movies. So that was like a big deal, let's go to the movies, so, because so many years ago. So she gave him 10 cents and said, you know, they're sitting at the movie, I'm hungry, can I get something? Here's 10 cents. With 10 cents, you can go buy a candy bar. And he said, with my little boy brain, I was looking at the candy bars and calculating in my mind, which one is going to get me more for my 10 cents? He saw one with a nice big package. So he said, I want that one. And when he opened up the package, inside the package was... He said, from that I can understand not just, you know, packaging isn't everything, but the very nature of the material world is the expectation is happiness and you get something else. It doesn't fulfill your expectations. It's the program of deceit. We call it marketing, but it's deceit. It's Maya says, come and enjoy me, come and enjoy me. And instead you get kicked in the face. This lecture that Prabhupada gave in Henry Street Temple in Brooklyn. Come on and enjoy me. Come on and enjoy me. So I can kick you in the face. That wasn't your expectation. The kick in the face part wasn't, but the enjoyment was the expectation. And we're under the influence of Kali by speaking untruths. And so one of the principles of getting back to the point where our mind can concentrate, even in challenging circumstances of life, the mind can remain concentrated upon Krishna, is when the mind is freed from that tendency for deception and untruth. I'll say it again. What's the purpose of this truthfulness? To assist the mind to be fixed upon Krishna. Not disturbed. Undisturbed. Because once you tell a lie, there's this, it might be a Shakespearean thing, What a wicked web one weaves when at first one deceives. You've heard that one before? You tell a little story. If someone says, you know, how many rounds have you chanted? And you say five. And then, you know, they're going with the information that you've chanted five. And then when it's time to do your service, you still haven't chanted your rounds. And they say, can you do your service? Well, I still have to chant my rounds. But wait a minute, you said you chanted your rounds. Well, then you have to make another lie to support that lie so you're not discovered that you lied. And so on. What a wicked web one weaves when at first one does deceive. So, unretena is it's deceit. It takes then the mind is very occupied with defending your position, you know, so no one discovers that you lied. And it's the whole pack of lies. And media is filled with stories of someone who deceived and then that deception built another deception and the next thing you know they're exposed. And their house of cards falls. It's over. And it's again and again and again. But by the influence of Kali, people keep doing it. So as aspiring bhaktas, those who are trying to advance in the path of devotion to Krishna, this principle of honesty, just be honest. Stay poor. Speak the truth. You know, in direct, plain, clear language, speak the truth. Why? One more time. It helps the mind become free from maintaining deception of others and including even self-deception. You can start to believe, yeah, I chanted five. Or whatever the story is, it's true. And they've done studies on this. Here's one study. A devotee who has his PhD in psychology was describing one study that was done. Was they a group that the experimenters with different socioeconomic background groups of people. They tried, it was a three-step thing. They asked the question, did this happen? You know, in the course of a conversation, they were asked, did this happen? And then the person would say, no, it didn't happen. It definitely didn't happen. And they assert, it happened. Second time around, I don't know. Third time around, it happened. You know, again and again, they become convinced by propaganda, just by lie, that it happened. They become convinced it happened. And they'll swear in a courtroom, with their hand on the Bible. It's true. It happened. It definitely happened. And so, this, according to the conclusion of this purport, false propaganda destroys truthfulness because we're in an atmosphere where we're used to hearing people say so many things we know are not true, but we can't, the mind becomes weak from not being able to understand what's true and what's not true. And so we buy into the whole program of, yeah, whatever. And that's true. Because I said it. It's got to be true. I'll stick to it. It's Kali. It's the influence of Kali. So the antidote to the influence of Kali is truthfulness. Then there's, we'll come back to, well, let's say now, there's standards of truthfulness. Truthfulness is not only just reporting something as you see it, because you also have to recognize the senses are imperfect. And so, as I see it, may not be accurate from what it actually is. And then we make mistakes. We can... Anyway. So, you know, let's say, where's your car keys? I can't find my car keys. I looked everywhere. Where are my car keys? And somebody else comes in and looks around and says, there they are. And you say, where are they? Right there. I don't see them. They're right there. Oh, there they are. We make mistakes. Even we see, we can't see. So the standard of truthfulness is this descending knowledge standard of truthfulness. Yes. And Prabhupada presents it this way. Supposing a small boy that doesn't know what is fire, his father says, my dear son, fire is like this. And then the boy repeats, fire is like this. So he may not have even experience of fire, but simply by saying what his father said, his speaking is truthful. Because he has faith in his father. His father hasn't deceived him. Fire is like this. That's what fire is. Or, therefore we can speak the truth, and by speaking, repeating this descending knowledge, and by faithfully abiding by that knowledge, we can come to the stage of realizing truth with a capital T. That's the standard in Satya Yuga of truthfulness. It's truth with a capital T. It's seeing things as Krishna sees things. In Sanskrit it's called Shastra Chakshus or Jnana Chakshus. Seeing things as Krishna sees them and reporting accordingly. Krishna discloses how he sees things in Bhagavad Gita. Here's the mode of goodness. Here's the mode of passion. Here's the mode of ignorance. This is what they look like. So then there's some display of goodness, and somebody asks, what is that? It's a display of goodness. We don't see the instrument standing alone. This person, he's fill in the blank. We see the mode of nature acting in a particular way. Therefore, we can maintain detachment while still seeing things for what they are. Detachment in the sense that we're not in this reactive mode that says, I don't like that person because look at that mode or look at their behavior. You can still have appreciation and neutrality towards the person, although you may not like the behavior. And then you can act as the well-wisher rather than getting against the other person because they just did something bad. And you know, getting all caught up in that material energy in the workplace, in your social exchanges and so on and so on. You can remain Krishna conscious by seeing things as Krishna sees things. That's, you know, the truthfulness of the Satya Yuga standard. Then there's austerity. Prabhupada describes austerity In a very simple definition, nice one. Austerity means to accept voluntarily things which may not be very comfortable for the body, but are conducive for spiritual realization. That's a nice definition. Voluntarily accepting things which may not be very comfortable for the body, but are conducive for spiritual realization. Not indiscriminate or whimsical kinds of austerities, extended fasting for 30 days or something like that, or protest, or burning up I was at the University of Massachusetts once, and one student, in protest of the war that was going on in the Middle East, he went to a hardware store, bought a couple gallons of kerosene, sat in the square of the town, poured the kerosene on his body, lit a match, and his body just went in protest of the war. That's not authorized by scripture. Certainly it's an austerity. he was a practicing Buddhist, and this was his expression of protest of the war. But austerities that are prescribed for the purpose of spiritual realization. Again, that's the target, and the austerity is accepted to help you achieve the target. Fastings which are meant not for self-realization, but for some other purposes are condemned in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 17, 5 and 6. So that's truthfulness, austerity, cleanliness. External and internal cleanliness. Prabhupada chooses, in this case, to focus on internal cleanliness. What does internal cleanliness mean? Chaita Darpana Marjanam. He uses the phrase accumulated material dust. That is, places where the mind may go or dwell that are in a dark place or apart from the Supreme. So, the means of cleansing the body, we, for the most part, we know cleansing the body is the process, and cleansing the mind, the process is glorification of the Supreme Lord. So Prabhupada states it positively and then states it negatively. Without glorification of the Supreme Lord, there's no possibility of cleansing the mind. And so, in an atheistic atmosphere, where Prabhupada was not happy with secularism that says separation of church and state. We have a secular government where, for their own reasons, those reasons are the decadence of Kali Yuga, where government people were using religion as a tool to get what they wanted done, and the religious people were using the government leaders to get control of the people. It's going on presently in Russia very nicely. The Russian Orthodox Church and the head of state are buddy-buddy. And they're both oppressive, and they both serve as instruments of oppression to assist one another's purposes. So, therefore, separation of church and state. There should not be a church state, or state, excuse me, a state church. Because it leads to corruption, but doesn't mean that the state should say, no God. God cannot be in the schools. You can't use the word. No prayer, no teaching, nada. Nothing. Separation of church and state. God's in the penalty box. And over here is atheism. No God. What's the result? Prabhupada explicitly says, you may get educated people, but they're going to have dirty minds. And those dirty minds are going to use those very powerful tools of education in a dirty way. Unavoidably. It's going to happen. It's a setup. It's a slam dunk for the personality of Kali. Get really smart people that have not been allowed, unless they kind of sneak or do it on their own or something, to cleanse their mind. It's very dangerous. Very dangerous. I'll share the story that I shared before, but it's relevant. Some time ago, at the University of Connecticut, I was invited to speak at a graduate anthropology class. I thought that was interesting, a graduate anthropology class. And it was because it was a graduate class, it was 2.5 hours long. It was a long class, and there were 3 speakers. And their topic was, the anthropology topic was, in the previous decade, what 3 very prominent forces affected the quality of the lives of people. And one of them was technology, computer technology. So the first speaker was the chairman of the computer technology department of the school. And so he spoke for about 45 minutes. And he began his speech by pointing out the window and see that building over there? That's our computer lab. And when we started our department, we didn't have the technology to know how to make a small computer. The whole building was a computer. One computer occupying the entire building. And that's where we started. And in the course of time, we got funding to do this and that and this and that. And, you know, we learned how to make computers that were more compact, and that became technology. And then it became applications of technology, and we got a contract from France where a telephone company wanted to find out if they could save some money by having people find out numbers, phone numbers, through computers. So we took the contract and supplied the product so they could get their numbers. And then following that, in France, there was a prominent bank, and the bank said, maybe we could use this technology that people can dial in and do their banking from home. So we developed that technology. And then the feedback from the customers of the bank said, well, while it's convenient, it would be much more personal if we could see the teller on a little video monitor while we're doing our banking from home. So can you develop that technology? Okay, so we developed that technology. The next customer was a prostitution ring that said, oh, I think we could market our girls very nicely if we could have pictures of them on the monitor and people right in their home could select their prostitute. And we didn't know what to do when it came to that. So therefore, we're turning to our next speaker, as they're the ones that are supposed to help us with that, because technology in the hands of people that don't know how to apply technology can end up in a worse situation than what you had before. So that was the red carpet for the next speaker. So what's the duty of, the Hare Krishna movement had a strong impact upon the population during a certain period of time. That was why we were one of the speakers. Eastern religion as a anthropological change in how people in America live. The influence of Eastern religion, Eastern thought. And specifically to bring people to the position of purity of mind. And you're not going to get, from this purport, you're not going to get purity of mind without glorification of God. It's not going to happen. It doesn't happen. And when you have purity of mind, then Prabhupada explains, then you can have peace. And when you have peace of mind, then you can contemplate the personality of Godhead. You can fix your mind upon the personality of Godhead, even in challenging situations of life. If you're regularly practiced at hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord, this is Bhagavad Dharma. This is our Srimad Bhagavatam. Shrinvatasva Kata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana. Or Tada Rajas Tamo Bhava Kama Lobhadriya Shri Cheta Etairanadvitam Stitvam Satve Prasidati. The mode of goodness becomes prominent. And the influence of passion and ignorance subside simply from this Bhagavad Dharma, the hearing and chanting of the topics of Krishna. That's what happens. It naturally evolves like that. So, cleanliness. External cleanliness. When you come into a situation, let's say a room or your work, a workplace, or your kitchen or whatever it is, whatever your field of activity is, and it's clean, it's inviting. You can be peaceful. And if the thing is a mess, or let's just not even say a mess, but if it's just not clean, your mind isn't peaceful. It's just not the same. Prabhupada's instruction was that a brahmana is one who, when they enter a place where they're about to do some work, the first thing they do is make the place clean. During the course of time when they're doing their activity, they're keeping the place clean. And when they're done, they leave the place more clean than when they began. That's external cleanliness. And then, more challenging even, is the internal cleanliness. But the path of this cleanliness is simple. Glorification of the personality of God. And so, here we have this Bhagavad Dharma that's it's pulling, used this metaphor before, but it's the locomotive that's pulling the train. But to support the locomotive that's pulling the train, this truthfulness, austerity, Krishna conscious austerity, Krishna conscious cleanliness, and mercy. And our mercy, the primary exhibition of mercy is the performance of Sankirtan Yajna, the congregational chanting of the holy name, and inviting people to take part, creating different types of circumstances, extending ourselves in such a way that persons can connect with Krishna. So, Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement is that primary compassion. But that primary compassion comes, say, cascades down, where the mercy goes to just helping another person even with ordinary things. Even ordinary things. Like, I'll give one example from a group of devotees where I move around. The husband, wife, two children. The husband had a routine checkup but he had a little pain, and they, sure enough, they found that he had a tumor in his brain. He was panicked. His wife was panicked because the parents were panicked, kids were panicked. You know, is it benign? Is it malignant? Where is this going to go? And immediately, the community took charge of, look, don't worry. For the wife, you have to go to work. Your kids need a calm situation at home. We'll take care of cleaning the house. We'll take care of all the cooking. You just attend to the needs of your husband, and we'll take care of everything else until all of this is settled. And it happened. It went on for like 2 weeks. And at the end of the 2 weeks, it turns out it was not a very critical situation. The doctors knew how to address it. And but they were overwhelmed. The wife shared with me with tears. I didn't have to worry about a thing other than, you know, caring for my husband and, you know, staying peaceful so I could, my children could feel that there was shelter, but everything was taken care of. We're so happy to be part of this community of devotees. You know, we want to be able to be like that when some situation happens with someone else. That's on the one sense, it's just mundane or worldly. Temporal. It's not the soul. But on the other hand, that extension of mercy, because it's in the sangha of those who are making Krishna the target of their life, it's showing the downstream character of one who is Krishna conscious, helping that family stay stable and fixed in time of very great challenge. Then another family, similar scenario, but you know, the family all came down with a very intense flu, including the mother. So she couldn't do any of her duties, and the two kids completely, you know, high fever and this and that. The community stepped in with their, you know, blessings. We'll take care of everything. We'll take care of making sure that the kids, and one of the kids got well so he'd make it to school. And don't worry, so we'll take care of it. It wasn't just one person that took care. It was a group of people that took care. And their expression to me was, wow. What I can't even imagine in my own family some that kind of care. Wow. And our family back home, they're amazed that, you know, what a wonderful group of people you're with. You're just, everything's taken care of. You should do the same, was the same response. But it's not just social welfare. It's Krishna consciousness. There is such a thing as social welfare minus Krishna consciousness. And there is such a thing as people trying to be Krishna conscious without taking care of each other. That's incomplete. So why do we want this mercy? So that when the quality of caring has as its target, ultimately, here's the personality of Godhead who's caring for us. He's giving us some strength, capacity, ability, resource. Let us extend that in service, especially to those who are very dear to Krishna. We can, to our capacity, we can extend beyond that, but at least we must do this. Like, you know, you must, if you're mother and father, you must take care of your own family. You're all busy running around taking care of everybody else's family, then you're neglecting your own family. That's not good. Charity begins at home, and then you can extend beyond that to your capacity. So I'll read the conclusion. First, Prabhupada's explaining, in Satyuga, there's fullness of principles of Dharma in each successive yuga. One fourth is missing, another fourth is missing, another fourth is missing. We're in Kali Yuga, one fourth is remaining, and that's weak and diminishing. Diminishing on account of prevailing untruthfulness. Conclusion. By pride, either artificial or real, the resultant actions of austerity is spoiled. People are doing austerity. Atheists are very austere. Running here and running there, get money, control, own, exploit. They're very busy in austerity. But the purpose is lost because of pride. So the proper performance of austerity checks that. By too much affection for female association, cleanliness is spoiled. This, Prabhupada explained, this gender-specific thing is used. You can turn it around the other way. Too much attachment for men. Too much attachment for women. By too much intoxication, mercy is spoiled. Too much addiction to intoxication, mercy is spoiled. By too much lying propaganda, truthfulness is spoiled. The revival of Bhagavad Dharma can save human civilization from falling prey to evils of all descriptions. So it's this parallel effort of principles of cleanliness, mercy, truthfulness, and austerity. Consciously cultivating those things so that the other parallel, fixing the mind in devotion upon the personality of Godhead and letting all of one's life activities be propelled by that devotion to the personality of Godhead, then you have a very nice situation. You have a progressive spiritual life. Any questions?
Maharaj, like, my question is, how, when we become non-judgmental, that really helps in Vaishnava relationships. And I'm seeing that, time and again I have to keep reminding myself that I have to be non-judgmental. But does it just come by natural, how does it come natural?
Judgmental is the word?
Yeah.
Judgmental is the word? Okay, I got the question. Just want to make sure. How to develop qualities is the question. Do they just come naturally or do we cultivate them? And the answer is good qualities come naturally, but you also cultivate them. You cultivate them in a Krishna conscious way. You cultivate them for the purpose of pleasing Krishna. So what's in front is, I want to please Krishna. What follows behind is, in order to please Krishna, this would help in pleasing Krishna. On the strength of the former, let me cultivate the latter. You lose perspective on the former, the other just becomes, splayed out all over the place. If focus is lost, the real quality even becomes lost. It becomes mush. So stay focused on, for the pleasure of Krishna, for the service to bring a smile upon Krishna, let me become like this. Then you cultivate behind that devotion to Krishna spirit. Will they also come even if you don't? Yes, they'll also come. Will it be enhanced if you focus? Yes, it will be enhanced if you focus for Krishna.
I had one question, not to exactly relating to this topic, Maharaj, but in the beginning of the lecture, it was mentioned the tenth chapter of Gita. Krishna says that nobody will know him, but in seventh chapter he says Manushana Thastena, in that word. He says, one hardly knows me. I'm like confused. I'm not trying to know, but which one is really doing?
The short answer is, by disclosure you can know. By the method of speculation, you can't know. Why can't you know? Because before you existed, Krishna existed. So how can you know what existed before you existed unless it's disclosed? By disclosure you can know. That's it's not a contradiction. Manushanam sahasreshu kashtid yatati siddhanam. Out of many thousands of people, Yatatamapi siddhanam kashyan mitivam tatvataha. One can know Krishna in truth when Krishna discloses himself. But if you're using this ascending process, you'll never know. You'll never know. That's the meaning. But is Krishna knowable? Yes. By disclosure. By figuring it out, not knowable. And Bhishmadev confirms.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. This class was very wonderful. I was able to really relate to today's class for a long time. And a couple of points which I wanted to bring in is the examples which you narrated. I think you had brought this couple of them during one of the lectures, because you have been hearing this lecture, so one of your lectures you have heard this. But I'm really able to feel it, in the sense, you know, how the devotees who are told you or narrated you, and in terms of how they were able to feel the production, I was able to really relate it. Thank you so much, because, you know, like, one thing which I want to highlight here is we are fortunate that we also have such a devotee association, and we were able to get the protection from Prabhu and Mataji. My question here is, I think you already said before, it's all good when hearing everything, you know, looks great, but when the real situation comes, the panic sets in. And
the storm.
Yes. So the panic sets in spite of me reaching out to our mentors, you know, whatever happens, it's okay, but the practically it doesn't work out at that particular point of time. Krishna takes a backseat, and we freak out, and, you know, it goes into a normal conditioning way of doing things.
Yeah.
So how do we practice
in purity.
So that's a constant. I would like you to.
There's the answer. It's not like you just snap your fingers and all of a sudden it's different. It might be nice if it was like that, but we might also take it cheaply if it was like that. It's not like that. It's not snap your fingers and next it's, you know, everything's different. It's a cultivation. We have tendencies that are not Krishna conscious tendencies, and those tendencies, especially when the complexities of Kali Yuga are ramping up, we turn to those conditioned tendencies to address, you know, the situation, rather than turning to the deeper resource of Krishna. And that's spiritual strength. That's a tendency. So, practice. A phrase that Prabhupada said over and over and over, and I would hear, and it gradually started to sink in, is when you practice, then that thing which you're practicing becomes second nature. So, okay, that's a nice phrase, second nature. What does that mean? So I have my nature, that's my conditioned self, goes into this, as you said, panic mode, and Krishna's in the back seat, and I'm at the steering wheel and trying to make sure that the thing reaches the goal safely, because I got to do it. And, you know, hang on for dear life, Krishna, because I'm in control. That's the conditioned. But you practice the other, and that becomes your second nature. It takes precedence by practice. It's just simple. Abhyasa. Like, from wherever and whatever the mind wanders due to its flickering nature, practice. Bring the mind back. Bring the mind back. bring the mind back. And practice, bring the mind back, and it becomes second nature. But that's not our conditioned nature. The conditioned nature is bahusha kahinantascha. That's our conditioned nature. We're splayed out. We're all over the place. Is it possible to be focused? Yes. Oh, how do you be focused? By practice. Constant practice. Krishna says. And by detachment. So, in two words, practice. And the various ways in which faith is nurtured. Practice with faith is stronger than mechanical practice. So there are ways that we can nurture faith. That's, what does Prabhupada write in Bhagavad Gita? Faith is created or awakened in the association of devotees.
One problem which I'm having is, I guess, even though I'm trying to practice, but the movement, whatever you do, that leaves a disaster, or, you know, the bad days at that particular point of time, and then, you know, you have to really go back and see.
So then you learn from it that what you're describing is life, and in life, there's learning. So you learn from your mistakes. And I just, you know, abandoned myself, abandoned Krishna, abandoned the spiritual platform, and I went into this animal thing, you know, panic mode. I did it again. So there's regret. Now let me make some steps in the direction of not doing it again. So let me, when it's calm, let me practice. So that when the storm comes again, I'm following that path, because it's I'm very familiar with this path. I feel very protected and safe. And so I'm going to stay there. Even when it gets crazy, I'm going to stay there. And you practice and practice, and it becomes, you never deviate from that. One of the important things to bear in mind, it's our nature. The other is the disease state, and this is our natural state. So much more strength is there in our natural healthy state than our diseased state. So many more resources, so much more strength, so much more clarity. You know, making wise decisions, and, you know, do I turn the steering wheel left or right? It's not just panic. It's very deliberate. And there's the Krishna factor that's just beyond my turning the steering wheel left and right.
Speaking untruth, or someone falsely glorifying someone else, how should I react? Is it that if I think that they are really falsely glorifying or speaking untruth, am I judging them, or it's up to me, or it's...
The whole question of judging is placing value, like guilty or innocent. It's one thing to just see things as they are and remain neutral. It's another thing to, you're bad. And then start to feel towards that person bad feelings. That's the judgmental part. Distinction is clear? one of the essential things in being situated in neutrality is to see the soul distinct from the covering of the soul. And that's not by mental adjustment, that's by spiritual realization. One of the things that can help, it's not yet at the platform of the soul, but I described, or I'll repeat it. Why is this person saying five rounds instead of four rounds? Why are they telling a lie? They know. They know that I know. And they're still saying it. Why are they doing that? There must be some pain inside. And they don't want to address that pain. They'd rather not address that pain and look somewhere else. It's because there's pain inside that they're doing like that. I can feel empathy for the person. Empathy isn't yet on the platform of the soul, but I can certainly forgive and understand why that behavior is there. They want something. They want relief from the distress that they're experiencing. It's not a relief from the distress to make believe something that isn't. But it's, you know, that's their behavior. So they don't have to address the pain. You can feel compassion instead of judgment. On the platform of the soul, It's far deeper, because then you've accessed Krishna immediately. Not just the mode of goodness, but so on the platform of the soul. Krishna, here's your part. I'm your part and parcel. They're your part and parcel. Even just going down that level of consciousness, mercy of Krishna comes into the whole dynamic. You become an instrument of Krishna, far better instrument of Krishna thinking in that way. Now, how do you do that? You have to take practice. It's not cosmetic. It's not putting on that face that says, you know, this is how I think. You know, then it's just self-deception. You know, it requires a genuine acceptance of the mood of the message of Krishna. Well, then, we need purity and practice. And to get purity, we pay the price. It's sustained effort over a period of time seeking the mercy of Krishna by prescribed means. And associate with persons who are pure so we can become a little bit like them.
All these points are very relevant to my present situation, and actually all this truthfulness, self-honesty, cleanliness, everything. I am so fortunate that I am in this association, and especially like Mataji once came and so lovingly she inspected my closet and she arranged all the things, and then she instructed, now you maintain. And then like the compassion, like my crazy decision, I had to go to Detroit, and it's a last-minute decision. And then Mataji was concerned about my late travel, and so she wanted my wife to accompany me. And then, in spite of her health and the busy schedule with the house and all that, she took care of my kids. And when this genuine quality is what you are asking us to cultivate, When we say that my heart is actually is completely filled with some gratitude and I try to reciprocate, but there is some guilt that is making me hesitate, Guru Maharaj. Guilt of committing one offense, and then like and my other quality I have Mataji has instilled is like in the reality check that I never did it right, and she taught me for the first time, like I was very happy, and I learned something about it. Like when we see something externally, and then when I feel something that this is not appropriate, but then I wanted to have a reality check with the intention that did I cause something, did I disturb or that. And then how the everything was explained, and then it was very informative and instructional, and actually that tendency is gone, but still the guilt of pulling them down to my level that is torturing me.
I was waiting for some clarification about what you mean by guilt, because that means different things to different people and it manifests itself in different ways, but you, at the end... At the end you clarified guilt specifically in bringing them down. So that's a noisy microphone.
Can I have it?
that the bringing someone down is that description, that act, that or placing oneself on, at least in one's mind, on the same level as those who are more advanced or superior. That's envy. That phenomenon is called envy, and you can feel guilty because there's that thing in the heart called envy. Misery loves company, and you so therefore, to solace your feelings of guilt, everyone in the material world has that which is distinct from the material in the spiritual world is in the spiritual world there's no envy. Or in the material world, everyone has envy. Otherwise, they'd be in the spiritual world. So, welcome to the material world. But it is certainly something that one needs to overcome. And back to the other question, how do you overcome something when there's a strong tendency? You practice and strive for purity. And purity means it's consistent. It's not sometimes when it's convenient, I'll strive for purity. And then, the other 99% of the time, because it wasn't convenient, I'm not. I'm going along, la-di-da-di-da, but thinking, this is a nice process of Krishna consciousness. It's la-di-da-di-da. Very nice. But the commitment to purity is something that's all the time. Even my capacity may be down here instead of up there, I'm striving, consciously striving, and then make progress. So it's the practice or constant striving And when there's constant striving, discrepancy can be overlooked. You learn so much from your children. I learn so much from children. If your children, you see that there's something that you'd like them to do, and they're not doing it all the time, but they're not rebellious towards trying to do that something, and they're trying. What do you feel? You're okay.
Yes.
You're okay. It's when they're not trying at all, however many times you try to help them understand it's important that you try, and they're not trying at all. Whatever it might be, you know, not cleaning their room, or just something simple, not brushing their teeth, or something, you know, not washing their hands after eating, or something. It's very, you know, why don't you do that? You know, they just don't even give an answer, or ignore you and walk right past you, like, unaffected. That's the part that's hurtful. It's not, sometimes they remember, sometimes they forget. Another way of saying the same thing, so the striving, another way of saying the same thing is remaining active within that relationship. And it's the strength of the relationship that takes us beyond our own limitations. Because look at our limitations and we're stuck. And therefore, the relationships with devotees, especially those who are guiding us and training us, those relationships are so important for us to get out of our stuck position. Now, going back to what you said, I feel guilty, not just because I'm stuck, but because this nature of envy says, let me bring them down, rather than let me enter into that relationship. It's definitely problematic. Like, mega problematic. It needs to move the opposite direction. By cultivation. Constant practice. Striving. Someone else? Without the microphone?
It's from the lecture, and I don't know the overall context in this Bhagavatam was spoken, but like, you were stressing on truthful, I mean, the three legs of Kali were broken. So,
the three legs of the bowl.
Sorry, bowl were broken, so it's like, it is still the same now, it's like,
yes.
Are the three?
Yes.
But,
cleanliness, mercy, austerity in the spiritual sense of austerity. Not that, you know, people get up and early in the morning and rush off to work.
I mean, we still see at least some of it, or how is it that truthfulness can bring about all of them, and we are still striving for austerity and all the remaining three, cleanliness, and so I mean, if truthfulness is going to bring about everything, I mean, why are we striving for getting all the four legs together? Or
okay, I've understood your question, and you've misunderstood the point. And my response is, it's not that just this one thing is going to take care of everything. We only want one leg. That's not the message. And by working on this one leg, the other leg will suddenly become restored. That's not the message. The message is, there is one leg that's only partially operative at present. That is valuable because it's at least partially operative. We should move that one leg that's partially operative into a really strong position. And at the same time, cultivate austerity, cleanliness, and mercy. And that we should do each of those four things for the purpose of pleasing Krishna, or fixing our mind completely upon Krishna. Not just so that we're clean, or so that we're truthful, but so that we're pleasing to Krishna, so that we can fix our mind upon Krishna when we chant the holy name, when we serve the devotees, when we go to the workplace, when we go to school, our thoughts are with Krishna.
Also, you are stressing on truthfulness in Satya Yuga. I mean, is it different from other ages or how?
Yes, it was full, as opposed to not full or broken or wobbly. So let's say truthful. The standard of truthfulness in Satya Yuga is the mind is fixed upon Krishna. The standard of truthfulness in the age of Kali is Bill Clinton saying, I did it. As opposed to saying, I didn't do it. That's quite a difference of standard of truthfulness.
So what is the standard that we are supposed to cultivate? I mean, what is the standard of truth we are supposed to cultivate?
We look at where we are. We look at the standard of the real standard of truthfulness, and we take steps towards that. For starters, start with self-honesty, and then disclosing to those next is disclosing to those who are very dear to us and confidential associates and are those guiding us, and be truthful with them. Like, you know, squeaky clean. There's nothing that I have to hide because of trust. And because of establishing that trust in the department of truthfulness, it can lend, that lends itself to being truthful in terms of our own spiritual identity, ultimately our relationship with our spiritual relationship with Krishna in the spiritual world. That's the Satya Yuga standard. That's the final, ultimate goal.
And then sometimes I find it difficult, like when you go outside, you cannot speak the same thing, and then...
Okay, so as you mature in your Krishna consciousness, that's, you know, looking forward to that wonderful moment as you mature in your Krishna consciousness, or that phase or stage where you discriminate how to speak to the people in the workplace or outside of the circle of devotees, but you certainly don't lie to them. You speak palatably. But you don't, you know, you speak appropriate for the circumstance. You don't just clobber them. A practical example is coming to mind. You know, I move about in the world, and someone comes up and says, "Oh, are you a monk?" No, when they're thinking monk, they're thinking a certain thing. So if I say, "Yes, I'm a monk," and then they, you know, in 5 minutes later, I'm sitting at my computer, they'll think, "What kind of monk is this?" So I don't want to, you know, I have to be thoughtful of their frame of reference, their context, of their way of viewing things. Actually, they don't just say monk, they say, "Are you a Buddhist monk?" That's the latest now. "Are you a Buddhist monk?" And the answer is, "Oh, I'm a monk, but not a Buddhist monk." so on. See? Appropriate for the circumstance, you speak the truth.
And actually, internally, there's a lot of conflict. Like, when you're talking to a person outside, they're in a completely different frame. And you know that's wrong. I mean, because
of compassion, you're thinking, here's a bite-sized, spoonful. And may just take a little, baby dip because they can't take more than that. Then they take that, let them. It's not deceit. It's discretion. It's not diplomacy. It's discretion. According to their capacity, this much they can digest. So I frame my response or my interactions with people according to what they can digest. And if you find out their capacity is greater, you can increase what's on the spoon. If you find their capacity is lesser than what you had estimated, you decrease. You're just a servant, that's all. That you're not being deceitful by being a servant according to their capacity you're serving. You're Krishna's servant. You're sent into that situation by Krishna. And, even more challenging can be with your immediate family. How much do I disclose to my immediate family? Because I don't want to be deceitful. But they're also the same principle. What's their capacity? How much can I put on the spoon? Because I'm their servant. I don't want them to push the whole preparation away. I want them to appreciate it's a nice preparation, so as they can take. It's discretion. It's not deceit. You're their servant. And that's your mood. You're Krishna's servant, and as Krishna's servant, you're his instrument in that dynamic as their family member that they're going to hear from in a particular way, because they're going to think of you in a worldly sense. You're my sister, or you're my daughter, or you're my niece, or something. And they're thinking of you in that world, the bodily conception. And you're not thinking simply in terms of that bodily conception. So appropriate for the circumstance. You're serving. Yes.
Maharaj, thank you for your class. I guess what Mataji was just asking, when you were saying we have to use discretion in preaching mode, and sometimes I feel very hard-hearted because I'll start talking to somebody or trying to help somebody, and then I'll just make the decision, this isn't somebody I can help. And so I just kind of withdraw from the situation. And I'm not sure
if that's appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, is it like, I feel like, okay, I have certain skills and I have certain things I can do. Should I go with that or should I?
Yes. Recognize your limitations. And it's not the other person's problem, it's my problem. If I were more qualified, if I was more pure, if Prabhupada was in this situation with this person, what would happen? That's what I do. And by Prabhupada's purity, the situation would improve. I don't have that purity. So, recognizing the shortfall is over here, not over there, let me work on that. Then you're not pretending something you're not. You're not bullying or making believe or something. You're being honest with yourself about there's more purity needed over here. Let me work on that. That's a nice position to be in. And then the person will not feel like you're shoving something down their throat. It's a good pill, take it. But it's too big. It's like a horse pill. I can't take it. It's good for you, take it. Because you know the shortfall is on our side. There isn't sufficient purity to make this assimilatable by the other person. I just don't have the capacity, the purity. And so, as you said, go with that. But go within and strive for purity. Not more tools or more information or, you know, more ways of packaging. Strive for purity. As long as you don't ask that same question. The application, I'm not sufficiently respectful to my mentors. I try, but I keep getting stuck. What do I do, Maharaj? Don't ask that question. You can ask any other question.
No, I'm getting confused. If it is similar. This is something which has been bothering me a lot.
Okay, go ahead.
To Mataji also. Actually, Maharaj, initially when I started Krishna consciousness, the relationship, the way I which perceive my mentors, I mean, there was no exactly a relationship like mentor, it was easy for me. I was able to more openly tell everything. But as I started hearing more and more, the respect for them grew more. And the thing is that what happened was there is a kind of guilty consciousness in me, which is also developing.
I've noticed a guilty consciousness in you. Mm-hmm. Is there, for sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. That is one thing is I'm not being a good student because whatever they are giving me, they are doing it so lovingly. That is, they are absolutely not judging me or doing anything that I'm able to understand, unlike the other kind of material teacher-student relationship. But still, on my part, I'm feeling like I'm not doing anything.
Yeah, this is the application question. What to do? Practice. If there's a each time I recognize there's some deficiency, which is often I recognize there's deficiency, what do I do? The Krishna conscious position is humility, reaching out to Krishna and requesting Krishna's kindness, at the same time redoubling my effort to do better than that insufficiency indicates. What I just said is the essence of the Damodar Leela. Mother Jasoda was trying to bind Krishna, and no matter how many ropes, she couldn't bind Krishna. But she didn't give up. She kept striving because in her motherly mood, it was her duty. She wasn't in a, I'm going to get him. It was duty of love for her son. So she kept, it's effort and mercy. And we continue practicing and exercising both effort and receiving mercy. and continue. And so the combination of these two, our progress in Krishna consciousness is assured. Krishna is merciful and Krishna will show His mercy. We open our hearts more to that mercy. Be eager to receive that mercy. And don't just wait around for Krishna to do everything. We're making our effort. Effort and mercy. Combination. And thank you very much. And Prabhupada,
His Holiness Srila Prabhupada Maharaj.